Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and historical fiction novelist Jean Mackin. Mackin received her BA in English from Ithaca College and her MFA in creative writing from Bennington College. She worked as a writer for the Ithaca Journal and the Ithaca Times, and from 1997 to 2004, she was a faculty member in the writing department at Ithaca College, as well as a faculty member at Goddard College in the MFA in creative writing program. Mackin is author of many acclaimed historical fiction novels, including The Sweet By and By, The Beautiful American, and A Lady of Good Family. Her new book, and what we'll be discussing on today's show, is The Last Collection, a novel of Elsa Schiaparelli and Coco Chanel, and it's due out in late June from Berkeley Books. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish.
Nice to have
you
back.
Thank
you. Yes. Now, I want to talk about the fact you spent 5 years reading and researching The Last Collection. What is it that sparked you to take on these two almost crazy, crazy women?
Yes, both a little bit crazy. I was fascinated by the intensity of the rivalry. I mean, they're two alpha women, very powerful, very competitive, and they crossed each other's paths in many ways. And they were just kind of fascinating to read about, to try to understand, because they were so different from each other. And as a writer, being able to develop a sympathy for both of them just really stretched me. I was so tempted to take sides, but I wanted them both to be full and multidimensional, so I couldn't do that. But they're fascinating women.
Yeah. You know what I had when I was reading the book, I was thinking, I wonder if Jean did take sides. Because I didn't either. I didn't know how to. They were both quite sympathetic in some ways.
That's good to hear, because that was an issue for me. I really wanted both women to have their share of the stage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it has to do with life. They had their share of troubles and sorrows. But, you know, Schiaparelli is not as well known as Coco Chanel. And why do you think that is? They ran in the same circles. They were in the same time. Well, why did Coco get most of the attention?
I think partially, or maybe to even a large extent, is because after the war, after World War II, Elsa Schiaparelli's designs were no longer as popular as they had been. They were a little too whimsical for the post-war frame of mind. And at one point, her shop, her salon, actually just closed. So she ended her career, her reputation, and Coco Chanel, as we know, has gone on and on and on. There has been a real good attempt to revive the House of Schiaparelli, and I hope they make it. I mean, some of her designs were really astounding and revolutionary in terms of fashion.
Uh-huh.
But she didn't last as long as Coco. She wasn't, in a way, as versatile as the Chanel clothing we come to think of as the Chanel clothing.
It's more classics in the Chanel line. And you know, Schiaparelli was influenced by Dolly and Man Ray, and you can see that in her patterns and in her styles. Talk to me about that. The connections with artists is so well known, especially in France before the war.
Elsa, this is one of the ways that Elsa Schiaparelli and Coco Chanel differed. Coco Chanel always saw herself as a dressmaker, as a craftsperson, as a couturier. Elsa Schiaparelli saw herself as an artist who worked in fabric. And she had a very close working relationship with Salvador Dali. They kind of cross-designed with each other. She made a dress once with pockets in it that opened like drawers that were kind of a reference to a Dali sculptor. And Man Ray, she did some surrealist imagery. There's one dress that had the pockets facing fabric was in the shape of a mouth, which was original and clever. But the more I looked at it, the more I realized it was probably Lee Miller's mouth. And Lee Miller was the woman I wrote about in The Beautiful American.
Yes.
She was Man Ray's mistress, and her mouth became that famous icon of the lips floating in the sky with no other part of the woman, just the mouth.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm fairly certain that when I saw that Elsa Schiaparelli design, it was another reference to Man Ray and surrealism, with the lips forming the opening to the pocket.
Yeah, yeah.
So she had that kind of whimsy and playfulness, but she did insist she was an artist, not just a craftsperson.
You know what? When I went back and looked at some of her stuff, she seems so modern. I mean, she seems as modern as Picasso's abstracts do, even now.
Absolutely. A lot of her clothes, even now, would be considered revolutionary and are still being made, but not under the Schiaparelli label. There's, you know, newsprint fabric started with Schiaparelli. See-through clothing, you know, the see-through shirts of the 60s go back to Schiaparelli, who once made a dress out of some kind of early form of plastic that tended to melt when it got wet. I mean, some of her clothes were a disaster, but they were fun and they were whimsical, and they really pushed the edge of what clothing is and what it's for. Yeah. But yes, totally revolutionary. Yeah. Many still now.
And still pushing the edge. But let's talk about Coco. She was brought up in an orphanage. Her father abandoned the family. Her mother got killed. To tell us about Coco's background.
Coco came from a working class family at a time of financial difficulty for many families in southern France. There were agricultural blights that were harming some of the industries in the south. Her father was a traveling man in every sense of the word, left the family for long periods of time, and her mother died of tuberculosis when Coco was still just a little girl, and the father was not there for them. He sent them to an orphanage. Coco later in life sometimes said she went to a convent because I think she thought it sounded a little more elegant than just an orphanage. But yeah, in fact, yeah, she grew up in an orphanage and was on her own from a very, very young age. And for a pretty young woman to be on her own from a very young age implies a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, and she actually used a lot of her orphanage years and experiences in her designs as well, which that fascinated me. She didn't try to run away from it.
She didn't. She was a very smart woman, and I think her clothing sometimes was working out some of her own demons and her childhood trauma. I think that's partially why she was very prone to, or very drawn to a black and white palette, nuns, grays, beiges, the neutrality. Her house in La Pausa in the south of France had architectural elements that absolutely were references to the orphanage where she grew up, and she even said so. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she was working through demons. Both women had demons. I mean, Elsa Schiaparelli grew up with a certain amount of privilege, but not totally beloved by her mother and not a pretty child. So she had a lot to overcome as well.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of women still do. I could see it while I was reading that book. Whoa, this is like now. You have a character in this book named Lily Sutter. I assume that's one of the fictional characters.
Lily is fictional. It? She's the narrator.
Uh-huh.
When I write historical fiction about well-known people, I prefer to use a narrator who is fictional, who can play off of the facts that we know about the historical people and interweave and create an arc that may not have been there in real life. For instance, writing about Coco and Elsa Schiaparelli, I really stuck to what we know about them. You know, I speculated on what some of their conversations might have been, but I stayed true to who I thought they were historically.
Mm.
So to really create that fictional story, I invent fictional characters that will kind of dance in and out with the real characters.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Lily is a fascinating character. You know, I felt that she was the connective thread that you were using to keep the two women in the story, which is fascinating for a fictional character.
She absolutely is the connective thread. And in fact, Lily is a reference to the color white. And white, as a color, represents the merging of all colors.
Mm.
People usually think black is all colors, but it's not. It's white. So she is the connection between everyone in the novel.
You know, just for the listeners, the one of the major landscapes and backdrops for this book is Paris, and before and after and during World War II. To tell us about Paris in that time, did you have to do a lot of research?
Quite a bit. It's the second novel that I've written in this time period, so some of the research had been done before. But there's a real puzzle and mystery to Paris in this time, in that it's represented in terms of literature and images with such an air of gaiety and bon vivant and insouciance and devil may care. And in fact, it was a very troubled time when people had to make difficult choices, because it was a very polarized time, kind of as we are now. And in Paris in the 30s, people pretty much had a choice between communism or fascism.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was very little in between, which left people really stranded philosophically and politically.
Yeah.
And it just continued to get more and more polarized, which, of course, is what, you know, helped walk this nightmarishly into World War II, was that polarization, that inability to find and hold to a middle ground where conversation could continue.
Yeah, and you don't dwell on the politics in this book, but it certainly is still in the foreground in many ways, which I find interesting. Did you want to go deeper into the politics, or you thought this should be somewhat neutral about that?
I didn't want it to be completely neutral, but I did want readers to understand the difficulties of that particular situation. Because there's so much historically that we still don't understand about that period.
Yeah.
Who was who and who was doing what and who believed what. For instance, Coco Chanel had a lover who was very, very high up in the German army. And she, you know, some people have suspected her of being a spy for the Germans because of that, of being a Nazi sympathizer because of that. But in fact, there's also the possibility that she was getting information for the French and the English governments because she was also a friend of Winston Churchill.
Yeah, yeah.
But we'll never know these things for sure, because some of the documents just are not there anymore. And if they ever were put in writing, some things are just gone. So when I was writing, I wanted to show the complexity of the situation. And yes, there is evil there. I mean, there's real evil in that background of what's going on. But who did what? We aren't quite as certain about, especially in France, where there were so many complexities.
Oh, yeah. And then there still are,
obviously.
Now, Schiaparelli and Chanel were on opposite sides politically. Schiaparelli was left-wing and Coco was more right-wing. Tell us about how you found the information about this.
For Elsa Schiaparelli, there are really two main books. Her own memoir, which she called Shocking Life, in homage to her famous color, Shocking Pink, but also a Meryl Seacrest biography of Elsa Schiaparelli that's very well-researched. Her memoirs are interesting in what they leave out, and they actually kind of made me respect her a little more, because she doesn't talk a whole lot about her lover. She doesn't name a whole lot of names. You have a sense of this woman, this gentlewoman, kind of trying to be discreet about what was actually a very wild past. And she had family, so she had to consider their feelings as well. Politically, Elsa, because she was from a privileged, educated family in Rome, she had that kind of ability to explore politically, I think, a little more than Coco Chanel felt free to, because Coco knew what hunger was. And knew how vulnerable she was. And when Elsa was hungry, it was because she was too proud to ask her mother for money. It wasn't because there wasn't any money. And it's a different kind of poverty.
Absolutely.
But because Elsa had a more sure fitting in this world when she was young, she ran off with a fake Polish count. They went to New York. They had a fake stage hypnotism act. And she actually joined the Communist Party. And I believe had leftist sympathies all her life, though when she became a famous designer, she really had to downplay it because her customers were wealthy people who tended towards the right.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Jean Mackin. We're talking about her new book, The Last Collection, a novel of Elsa Schiaparelli and Coco Chanel, due out in late June from Berkeley Books. To talk about Schiaparelli's daughter, she has a daughter who has a huge presence in this book.
Her daughter, Gogo, was the only child that that Elsa had, and she was born to Elsa and her fake count husband.
Now that sounds like it's full circle into our era.
Yeah, and Gogo was a very beautiful, beautiful young girl, beautiful in a way that Elsa wasn't, because Elsa's husband was just this gorgeous Polish man. Polish men can be really good looking. I'm married to one. Just throw that in. But as a child, when Elsa was still in New York, trying to earn a living without going home for money or anything, she sent Gogo to live in the country, as women often did, especially working women, and went to visit her and realized that her daughter wasn't walking and was barely crawling. And in fact, Gogo had developed polio.
Yeah. Yeah.
And spent years going through different therapies and surgeries and all of the recuperative attempts that people went through at that time. And Gogo eventually recovered very, very well. I mean, she was straight. She walked. I don't think there was a noticeable limp. But I think it created such emotional hardship between herself and her mother, because her mother's off busy earning a living, and Gogo, to a large extent, in boarding school after boarding school, is going through quite a bit of this alone.
Oh, yeah. And also the image, you know, I mean, that was one of the major focuses for these women who designed clothes, right?
Appearance.
Yes.
Yeah. And Scapirelli is actually kind of funny, because she wasn't, that I found, ever that worried about the physical appearance that polio left on Gogo. But at one point, when Gogo was in an English boarding room and Skep went to visit her there, or boarding school, Skep went to visit her, and Gogo had gained a lot of weight because she was eating what was the typical diet of bread and potatoes and desserts and puddings. And Elsa was really put off by that her daughter had actually gotten fat. So she took her daughter out to a restaurant and fed her beef, no more bread and potatoes, you know. And so she was more upset about Gogo having gained weight than having been ill, which I thought was, that's kind of a motherly thing to do. And boy, that's a fashion designer for you.
Yeah, and that's also still part of our modern world, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, I want to ask you, too, I find historical fiction fascinating. Why have you chosen to write this instead of pure history or pure fiction? Because you have all the aspects of all those things in these books.
Well, I don't write pure history because I'm just not a scholar. A lot of the resources and research I do is secondary reading, not primary. I don't scan through archives that often. Once in a while, I will. So I'm not really a scholar. And I want to feel free to speculate. My mind moves into fiction. Why it's historical, I really can't say, except I was just reading some comments on Facebook about a woman who had tried to write a historical novel and said, I can't, I just don't see the story there. And I'm just the opposite. I don't see the story now. I see the story in history as a backward glance.
Yeah, adding creativity and a flair at your own will is part of what historical fiction is, too.
Yeah.
Do you ever worry that people take the fiction as historical and the vice versa and start using that as their narrative of real life?
I do worry about that, especially now. I think borders are much more porous than they used to be between genres and categories, both in the visual and the imagistic arts. But at some point, you have to just let go control, and what a reader takes is what a reader takes. And that's why when I was working with Elsa Scapirelli and Coco Chanel, I really stuck as close to fact as I could, so that if a reader came away from that with their impression of either woman or both women, it is based on the reality of them as I saw it and as their biographers saw it. I really did not invent a whole lot about them.
Yeah, yeah. What caused the rift between them and the rivalry and so on? Do you know?
I think it was pretty classical, actually, because Elsa was a little bit younger than Coco. Coco was established already one of the richest women in the world when Elsa Scapirelli set up her business in Paris. But you're never completely secure in your reputation. You always have to keep building on it. You don't want to give it up to someone else. And here is this younger woman who's getting all sorts of attention because she's very kind of flashy and dashy and glitzy, and instant rivalry between the two women.
Yeah, and you portray it so beautifully.
Thank you.
Because, you know, I'm when I heard that this was a book about the rivalry, I was thinking, oh, it's going to be a bunch of fights. But it's very subtle.
Their rivalry got very intense and almost mortal at one moment.
But the book doesn't show that. It's passages of time and their own personalities and not necessarily the horrible bitterness and fighting that went on. I wanted to ask you this, too, because I found it really interesting that you intimate that Coco Chanel had a little relationship with morphine. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. And in fact, it was very, I won't say it was very common. I will say it was not uncommon in Paris. People got a little help for sleeping. Mm-hmm. They used cocaine. They smoked grass. I mean, they were not Puritans by any standard. And my generation certainly were not door openers in the sense that this had already happened before. But yeah, there was a lot of drug usage in Paris. In France in general, and in other parts of Europe, and to some extent in this country as well.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, was Coco considered an addict? Can you tell?
I don't know if they thought of addiction completely in the terms we do. I mean, she wasn't on the street banking money for a fix, that's for sure. And I don't think she was addicted in that she put anything at risk to maintain a difficult drug habit. She used drugs to help her sleep, maybe once in a while recreationally, but I don't think it was addiction is the way we think of it now.
Yeah, yeah, but people weren't using it against her, right? Look at that addict sitting there.
Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's different times.
Absolutely.
They were more modern then, it seems.
They sure were.
You talk about Germans building walls around Jewish neighborhoods in Poland in this book. You touch on that. That struck me as so contemporary.
Oh, yes.
We are back to talking like that.
About walls.
Weren't you astounded when you were doing the research for this?
Most of the research for this book just astounded me and frightened me. When I began working on it, I wear blue jeans and boots. And for me, writing about two women who are high fashion designers was a stretch right there. But when I realized how much the fashion tied into the politics, and then at the same time, I'm looking out my window, I'm seeing women in pink pussy hats marching for the resistance.
Oh,
I thought, oh, yeah, this is, we wear our political beliefs, whether we know it or not. And they did then, too.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It was so amazing. It does feel like we haven't gone much past this part of history, the 30s and the Second World War. Now, both these women made it through the war. To tell us where they ended up and how that progressed.
Coco spent the war in France, and she spent a good deal of it living in the Ritz among the German soldiers, the officers who were stationed there, which did not help her reputation a whole lot after the war. Elsa Schiaparelli left Paris right before the Germans came in and traveled largely in the United States and also in South America. And she got in a little trouble for the amount of traveling she did in South America because there were people in our government who thought maybe she was spreading propaganda for communism.
Mm-hmm.
So both women got in trouble during the war, not always for the same reason, but it was such an intensely political time. Of course, it was a war, and you're either on our side or you're not on our side. And both women had to face accusations of being on the wrong side, even they were both on different sides. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. What do you think, when all is said and done, I mean, they're both dead. They have been for, three decades. What do you think their legacy is and how they're still affecting our culture?
Well, Coco Chanel's legacy is apparent. I mean, her line is still being manufactured, experimenting. There are Coco Chanel items that are just iconic. you know, the quilted purse, the little tweed jacket. Coco Chanel's just goes on and on.
Yeah, Chanel number 5, everybody knows that.
Absolutely. And Elsa Schiaparelli's legacy, I think, is a bit more subtle. But in fact, she allowed women designers to kind of grow slightly beyond the role they'd had before, more into the arts, more experimental, more whimsical. She made clothing more of a statement and not something that you wear for evenings out or practical days in the office.
Yeah.
But she opened the doors to that kind of whimsy and fun.
Yeah, she broke through the lines of, you know, people were having established ideas of what women should look like in fashion.
Right.
In many aspects.
Right.
So she broke through that. I mean, just like an abstract painter, just like one of the Impressionists. It's quite amazing. Were there any huge surprises while you were at least researching this book?
The surprise for me was how fond I became of both women.
Mm.
Because I really did. I mean, for me, Elsa is about the intelligence and the sense of humor and the wit and the ambition. Coco was about the ambition, but also about overcoming those childhood demons that were so difficult for her. I mean, she, I think, remained for me the loneliest woman I've ever had to read about.
Really?
I think so, yeah. She didn't stay close to people. I mean, she stayed close to lovers. She had a lot of male friends that were close to her for a long time. But family, no. She was ultimately a very lonely, I think, person. I tried to create that image of her in the novel. There are a few sections where she is alone, even though she's surrounded by people.
Yeah.
She is alone. And I don't think Elsa was like that. She had a sister. She had her daughter. Her family extended and grew around her, even if they weren't always happy about it,
but they
were there.
So do you think Coco was just not as trusting because she had been brought up in an orphanage?
I don't think she was at all trusting.
Yeah.
And no.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating portrait. Tell us what you're working on now. Any new ideas skating around your world?
I'm still in France. I've gone a little backward in time, though, to the 1920s, and looking at politically the introduction of Mussolini concept.
Wow.
I know. I can't get away from war.
Well, I can understand why it keeps going in circles.
We don't leave it behind, do we?
I don't think so, yeah. And that's why this book really brought that to the light. For me to remember that we're still in this in some ways.
Yeah, and it feels sometimes like the Civil War never ended, like World War II never ended, and of course World War II was a continuation of World War I, and sometimes you just sit back and say, do we ever get any smarter?
No, I don't think we do. Jean Mackin, can you give some contact information and tell us if you're going to be giving any readings this summer?
Yeah, I'm going to be reading at Buffalo Street Books on June 26th at 6 p.m. A couple of other readings. There'll be one in New Canaan, Connecticut. I'm going to be at the Historical Novel Society in June in Maryland. My website is www.jeanmackin.com, JeanMackin.
Well, Jean Mackin, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure to see you again, and also this book was great. It really was.
Thank you. Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.